All right, hello everyone. I'm happy to be here for I Am That again because of my travels. It's been a long time, so it feels really good to be back. Hi, George. Tonight I am going to begin on message 12, which is called The Person Is Not Reality. And so the questioner asks, kindly tell us how you realized. And Nisargadatta says, I met my guru when I was 34 and realized by 37. Questioner asks, what happened? What was the change? Nisargadatta says, pleasure and pain lost their sway over me. I was free from desire and fear. I found myself full, needing nothing. I saw that in the ocean of pure awareness, on the surface of the universal consciousness, the numberless waves of the phenomenal worlds arise and subside beginninglessly and endlessly. As consciousness, they are all me. As events, they are all mine. There is a mysterious power that looks after them. That power is awareness, self, life, God, whatever name you give it. It is the foundation and the ultimate support of all that is, just like gold is the basis for all gold jewelry. And it is so intimately ours. Abstract the name and shape from the jewelry, and the gold becomes obvious. Be free of name and form and of the desires and fears they create, then what remains? So I guess it's kind of funny because I don't really feel like just reading. I feel like if I just read, contemplation doesn't occur, and I want contemplation to occur, and yet I can't honestly say I have anything to say about what Nisargadatta has just said. Maybe what I can do is just emphasize some of what he just said before I move on. He's referring to what he realized between the ages of 34 and 37. And one of the things that he's commenting on that he realized was that on the surface of universal consciousness, the phenomenal worlds arise and subside beginninglessly and endlessly. And what that really says to me is that it's noticing in the coming and going of everything, right? The birth and death of everything. That what's truly happening is an ongoingness. It's like when you're attached to the form, you notice the beginnings and the endings. Even though the ongoingness is obvious, you don't really see that or focus on that. But when you awaken to consciousness and you awaken to life, then in spite of the same comings and goings, the same beginnings and endings, the same birth and death, what you're focused on is the ongoingness of life. So it really is a shift in perception. because the form doesn't change. The form is still birth and death, coming and going, beginning and ending. But instead of being focused on that, the shift in perception is focused on the ongoingness of life and how it continues. He says, as consciousness, they are all me. Which, of course, means that he sees himself as consciousness. As events, they are all mine. Or another way to maybe say that is, it's all happening within me. It's all happening within consciousness. And then he says there's a mysterious power that looks after them. DI refers to that as the power behind the script. It's the interdependent co-arising. It's the creative principle interacting with the second principle of God in order to create the ongoing appearances. And he says it's so intimately ours. And then he ends with this comment that, again, if you take the name and the shape of the jewelry away, the gold becomes obvious, right? If you don't say ring, bracelet, necklace, right, it's obvious that they're all gold. And he says if we take the name and the form and the desires and the fears out of this experience, and then he ends with what remains. If you take the name and the form and the desires and the fears they create out of it, then what remains? What's here? And the questioner says nothingness. He answers the question with the word nothingness. And Nisargadatta says, yes, the void remains, but the void is full to the brim. It is the eternal potential, just as consciousness is the eternal actual. The eternal potential. And the questioner says, by potential, you mean the future? And Nisargadatta answers, the past, the present, and the future. They are all there, and infinitely more. The questioner says, but since the void is void, it is of little use to us. And Nisargadatta says, how can you say so? Without a breach in continuity, how can there be rebirth? Can there be renewal without death? Even the darkness of sleep is refreshing and rejuvenating. Without death, we would have been bogged down forever in eternal senility. Just before I turned on Pal Talk, I just went and quickly looked at Ricky Tim's Facebook page. The retreat house that we are buying in La Vida belongs to his partner, Justin Schultz. And Justin and Ricky are moving into a new house, and I'm sure some of you guys know this story. They're moving into a new house that they just finished in March. It's a big, beautiful million-dollar home on 40 acres in the mountains. But those 40 acres burned in the spring fire about a month ago. And while the spring fire was burning and we were waiting to see if their new house burned or not, because we knew that if their new house burned, they would not want to sell their old house, which is the one we were planning to make an offer on. So during the fire, I was watching Ricky Tim's Facebook page, you know, every day and finding out what I could about what was going on with the fire and with them. And it was, I really kind of got to know these guys as I was watching their Facebook page. So since then, about once a week, I kind of go and check in, and still continuing their adventure with them because, because it's an interesting adventure. And so today I checked Ricky Tim's page just before coming here, and he has some lovely shots on his Facebook page of, again, the 40 acres around their house completely burnt. But he has some lovely pictures of nature already coming back, of the plants coming up through the ground, a couple of trees, some have some pine needles, green pine needles that are emerging as the tree is attempting to come back to life. And they're really lovely, lovely pictures. Well, Nisargadatta is really talking about that same thing here. Again, his focus is on the ongoingness. But he's pointing out that, we become attached to form and we think that we want, like, I want Regina to continue forever. That's just what the mind thinks, that I would want Regina to continue forever. And really, Nisargadatta is pointing out that's not as ideal as we think it would be. That in form, it really is nice to have renewal. It's nice to have death so that you can have birth, right? It's nice to have the old pass away and the new come into being. And there's nothing wrong with that. And so the questioner responds to that saying, is there no such thing as immortality? And of course, the questioner is probably thinking from the same perspective as most people, from the perspective of attachment to form, which means, I want this form to live forever. I don't want this form to die, just so life can be new again, have newness to it. Which, of course, maybe most people don't see it, but that's a very selfish perspective. It's a very limited, it's a very little perspective. But the questioner says, is there no such thing as immortality? And Nisargadatta says, when life and death are seen as essential to each other, as two aspects of one being, that is immortality. To see the end in the beginning and the beginning in the end is the oh boy, I'm having trouble with big words tonight. Intimation. I think he means, I don't know what he means. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to look it up. I think it means imitating, but I could be wrong. Let's see, where is it? Intimation. What does this mean? Oh, it's a hint. I like the word hint much better. I can say that more easily. So I'm going to use the word hint. To see the end in the beginning, and the beginning in the end is the hint of eternity. Definitely, immortality is not continuity. Only the process of change continues. Nothing lasts. So again, it's as I said when I began this sharing from the person is not reality. When we're attached to the form, we see the beginnings and the endings, and we focus on them as if, a particular life begins. I'll use the example of my impatient dog, Jamie. She had a beginning. I remember her beginning. And, someday within the next year or two or three, she'll have an ending. And I can focus on the beginning of this form, Jamie. And I can focus on the end of this form, Jamie. And I think something meaningful came into being and then died. And I might even think I lost something meaningful. But the awakened mind isn't focused on the form. The awakened mind is focused on the life awareness. And what the awakened mind sees is that when one form ends, another form begins. And that doesn't mean, of course, that Jamie was reincarnated. It means life can't end. There are different forms all of the time, but life is ongoing. And the awakened mind is focused on the ongoingness of life rather than the coming and going of specific forms. There's a song I want to play, if I could think of the name of it. Okay, I got it. This isn't really the name of the song, but fortunately, other people don't know the name of the song either, and they have typed into YouTube this one line from the song, and therefore, I was able to find it based on the line that I could remember. This song is really talking about being focused on life rather than focused on form. It's by Blood Sweaters, and it's called When I Die.
In a world to carry on.
Funny how that song has become one of my favorite songs. You know, something has happened in me, and I guess it's a shift. I don't know what else you would call it, but it's not that I think I'm dying anytime soon. It's not that I have cancer that I know of or anything like that. But there's something in me that's very happy. It's a peaceful, joyous happiness, the same kind of peaceful, joyous happiness that that I experience just like on this perfect weather day when you're outside and just loving the day, you know, that peaceful, the sunshine on my shoulders kind of happiness. I have that same happiness now about the fact that I can die. And the only way I know how to explain that is that in most humans, and once upon a time on me, in me, because of our attachment to the form that we call me, the body that we call me, there's an inherent resistance to death. An inherent resistance to death, and it's not that we live our whole life consciously thinking, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. But we see death as a bad thing. Most humans do. And whenever this realization of life comes over you, it's kind of a joy. It's hard to explain, but it's kind of a joy to know that you can die. And what that really means is there's no more resistance to death left. You can die. It's okay. It's, life goes on. Life doesn't end. This temporary mortal body can, and nothing is actually affected by it. Nothing has changed. Life goes on. It's like Ricky Tim's pictures on Facebook, you know, where this fire just 25 days ago, you know, people saw it as destroying the forest. And yet he has all these lovely pictures of already the forest coming back. Right? You can't destroy life. I can die because life doesn't end. And there's a genuine joy in that. And so this is what Nisargadatta is attempting to really explain. Immortality isn't about a form continuing. Immortality is seeing that life itself is a continuation. I'll go on to the questioner says, awareness lasts? Question mark. And Nisargadatta says, awareness is not of time. Time exists in consciousness only. Beyond consciousness, where are time and space? So I think that when Nisargadatta uses awareness, he uses awareness the same way I do, which would be referring to the first principle of God. And you can't place the first principle of God within consciousness or within the world, within the fourth principle of God, because consciousness is within the first principle, right? And the world is within consciousness. So you can't try and pull that first principle of God into your perspective of the world and ask, does awareness last? Awareness is beyond time, which is exactly what Nisargadatta is saying. It's beyond birth and death. So in effect, it's beyond the word lasts. Does it last, right? Does it last? That word lasts, you know, continue, that word occurs within an assumption of time. within an assumption of some things begin, some things end, and then kind of a question, what lasts, right? So it's within that framework. And Nisargadatta is saying awareness is outside of that framework entirely. The questioner says, within the field of your consciousness, there is also your body. And Nisargadatta says, of course, but the idea my body as different from other bodies is not there. To me, it is a body, not my body. A mind, not my mind. The mind looks after the body all right. I need not interfere. What needs to be done is being done in the normal and natural way. And this continues, but I just want to, before I continue, I want to comment on what he means by, I see a body and not my body. Because, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if somewhere else we could read Nisargadatta referring to, quote, my body. But I don't see that as a contradiction. Because I think what he's really saying, you know, just what he's really saying here is, I identify with this body as what I am. I see this body just like I see all other bodies. It's a temporary manifestation. It had a birth and it will have a death. But I don't see it as what I am. Now, in another place, there could be a different discussion, you know, where Nisargadatta could say something like, well, my body breathes. My body sees a world, right? And that would just be the convenience of language. That doesn't mean that he's identified with a body in those particular sentences. That just means that he is explaining that the body that is perceived as him is just like every other body. It breathes, it sees a world, it's no different because he's self-aware. But he's definitely not identified with the body. He says, you may not be quite conscious of your physiological function, but when it comes to thoughts and feelings, desires and fears, you become acutely self-conscious. To me, these two are largely unconscious. I find myself talking to people or doing things quite correctly and appropriately without being very much conscious of them. It looks as if I live my physical waking life automatically, reacting spontaneously and accurately. So what he's describing here is that there's not an idea in the mind that I am doing the talking, I am doing the walking, I am doing the work. The talking is happening, the walking is happening, the work is happening. So the connection that occurs in the mind of most humans, that I thought, then claims the talking, the walking, and the doing, the working. That doesn't occur within him. And so the body is able to be completely spontaneous, spontaneously moved by the creative principle without any idea of a me that's driving it. The questioner says, does this spontaneous response come as a result of realization or by training? Nisargadatta says both. Devotion to your goal makes you live a clean and orderly life, given to searching for truth and to helping people. And realization makes noble virtue easy and spontaneous by removing for good the obstacles in the shape of desires and fears and wrong ideas. So what I hear Nisargadatta saying here is the training came first. Like there was a period, you know, there was a period before realization occurred when I had a goal of realization. That was my purpose. And when I had a goal of realization, I was doing my best to live by, and he doesn't say this, but it's what we would call the right mind instead of the wrong mind. He says, devotion to your goal makes you live a clean and orderly life, given to searching for truth and to helping people. So from the period of time that you decide that you want to awaken, that you want to be self-realized, when that comes your goal, if you are really devoted to the goal, then you begin immediately in to the best of your ability, letting go of the ego or the wrong mind, and therefore not living by the ego or the wrong mind, and instead living by intuition or the right mind. And at this point, that is not spontaneous. It's training. And of course, this is the point that most everyone here is at, right? It's not spontaneous right living. You are training yourself to right living. You are training yourself to let go of ego or ignore ego or not speak or act based on ego, but instead to speak and act based on the right mind and the intuition. But then he goes on to say, and realization makes noble virtue easy and spontaneous by removing for good the obstacles. So during the training phase, what we do is we learn discernment. We learn the difference between the wrong mind and the right mind. And to the best of our ability, we live according to the right mind and disregard the wrong mind. And of course, as you know, in the beginning, we may want to do that, but not be so good at it. But we continue the training process, and over time, if we're really devoted, we become better and better at living from the right mind and disregarding the wrong mind. But I don't think perfection ever comes during the training phase. Even though we get better and better at it, I think, at least in my experience, there's still these occasional slip-ups because the wrong mind is still there, because the ego is still there, and so occasionally it grabs our attention so fast and we act with it so fast that we didn't catch ourselves with our own discernment. But after true self-realization, which is often referred to as the ego death, the obstacle of the ego or the obstacle of the wrong mind is no longer present. If it's no longer present, if it's no longer there, we no longer have to discern between the right mind and the wrong mind because there is no wrong mind. We then can let go of the discerning faculty, which is actually a form of judgment, but it's a helpful form of judgment. We can then let go of the discerning faculty. We no longer have to discern because there is nothing to discern between. And we can just be and let all speaking and all doing happen automatically, and it will always be of the right mind. So this is a pretty important point. What this means is until the ego is dead, we have to practice discernment. We're in the training phase, learning to live, as the words that he uses are, by virtue, a clean and orderly life, right? But after realization occurs and the obstacle has been removed, the ego has died, then, as he calls it, noble virtue is easy and spontaneous, and discernment is no longer required. The questioner says, don't you have desires and fears anymore? Nisargadatta says, my destiny was to be born a simple man, a commoner, a humble tradesman with little formal education. My life was of the common kind, with common desires and fears. When, through my faith in my teacher and obedience to his words, I realized my true being, I left behind my human nature to look after itself until its destiny is exhausted. Occasionally, an old reaction, emotional or mental, happens in the mind, but it is at once noticed and discarded. After all, as long as one is burdened with a person, one is exposed to its idiosyncrasies and habits. So, he says that he has kind of left the person behind to look after itself until its destiny is exhausted. And sometimes he sees the old person acting like the old person, just a smidgen, right? Just a little. But that he just kind of notices that and discards it. And I don't want to claim to have the same experience of Nisargadatta because I you know, don't think that I do. But I can tell you that I see Regina much, much differently than I once did. Once upon a time, Regina was who I am. At least that's what I thought. And when Regina was who I am, everything that she said and did was very important to me because I was constantly judging myself against some imaginary criteria. You know, so Gina would say the right thing or she'd say the wrong thing. She'd do the right thing or she'd do the wrong thing. She'd look the right way or she'd look the wrong way. You know, there was constantly some kind of an imaginary criteria present that as I thought of myself as Regina, I was constantly judging myself against and finding myself either in approval or not in approval, right? Like sometimes I was on the good side of that. Oh, that was a smart thing to say. And sometimes I was on the bad side of that. Oh, that was a dumb thing to say. But there was a constant measuring occurring, a constant judgment. And to be honest, as I say that out loud now, it amazes me. That should have been exhausting. I'm not sure why it wasn't. But now what's happened? Is that Regina is more like something I live with rather than what I am. I live with this ongoing picture or appearance. And I see everything that goes on. You know, everything that the body does, everything, all of the thoughts that come through the mind, all of the emotions or physical feelings that go through the body. But they don't have meaning as me. They're what I'm watching rather than being me. They're the object that I that I watch. And so, because it's just what I'm watching rather than being me, it means that this constant judgment no longer occurs. This constant measuring stick is no longer there. And I don't know if Nisargadatta is trying to describe the same thing or not when he says, I left behind my human nature to look after itself until its destiny is exhausted. Occasionally, an old reaction, emotional or mental, happens in the mind, but it is at once noticed and discarded. After all, as long as one is burdened with a person, one is exposed to its idiosyncrasies and habits. Interesting, the questioner says, are you not afraid of death? And Nisargadatta says, I'm dead already. And the questioner says, in what sense? And Nisargadatta says, I am double dead. Not only am I dead to my body, but to my mind as well. I love that. I am double dead. So he is not identified with the body and he is not identified with the mind. That identification with the body and with the mind has been severed. Again, the body and the mind is just something that is observed. It is watched. It is present, right? But he does not in any way see it as him. Now, it's funny because again, he says, I am double dead. Not only am I dead to my body, but to my mind as well. And the questioner says, well, you do not look dead at all. And Nisargadatta says, that's what you say. You seem to know my state better than I do. And that's a really interesting line, because another thing that I have learned just through my own experience of shift and change is I've learned that the statement that we see through the filter of our mind is an incredibly true statement, and that we make assumption without realizing that we're making an assumption, that everyone else's experience is like our experience. We don't even know that we're making that assumption until enough shifts have occurred that we have memories, at least slight memories. For me, the memories really fade, so they don't feel like alive memories. They feel like intellectual information. But we have memories of how we used to see, how we used to think, how we used to be attached to the body and mind. And we have the contrast of the difference between how we experienced the body and the mind and the world before, and how we experience the body and the mind and the world now. And there's such a drastic difference between the two that we now realize that most people who are still in that position where we began, most people cannot fathom the current experience that I am having or that Nisargadatta is having. They can't fathom it because, you know, it's kind of like a 3-year-old trying to imagine what it's like to be a 30-year-old. A 3-year-old can't fathom what it's like to be a 30-year-old, but a 30-year-old remembering what it's like to be a 3-year-old is very aware of the difference between the two. So Nisargadatta says, you seem to know my state better than I do, knowing, of course, that the questioner doesn't. You know, the questioner is the 3-year-old and Nisargadatta is the adult, and he knows the 3-year-old can't imagine adulthood. In this case, it's a very polite 3-year-old. The questioner says, "I am sorry, but I just do not understand. You say you are bodiless and mindless, while I see you very much alive and articulate." Nisargadatta says, "A tremendously complex work is going on all the time in your brain and body. Are you conscious of it?" "Not at all. Yet for an outsider, all seems to be going on intelligently and purposefully. Why not admit that one's entire personal life may sink largely the threshold of consciousness and yet proceed sanely and smoothly?" Some types of examples that Nisargadatta uses from time to time is things like, "Are you conscious of your hair growing? Are you conscious of your food digesting in your body? Are you conscious of your heart pumping blood throughout your body?" All of these things are happening perfectly without you being conscious of it. So why not accept that this body can be speaking spontaneously, moving spontaneously, and working spontaneously without having a driver, without having an I, a person that is making the speaking happen, right? Making the doing happen? Why not trust that the same nature that is able to grow your hair and pump blood through your body and digest your food, just to name a few, why not trust that that same nature can also cause the body to speak, act, work? And in fact, that nature would be what Nisargadatta talked about earlier in this same message when he said there is a mysterious power that looks after everything in manifestation. That power is awareness, self, life, God, whatever name you give it. It is the foundation and the ultimate support of all that is. We could also call it consciousness. So he says, it's really, if you really contemplate, it's not that hard to believe. If your body and brain can function perfectly without you driving it, without you telling the brain how to see. The brain actually sees, not the eyes, right? You don't tell the brain how to see. You don't tell the brain how to decipher language and understand. You don't tell the brain how to recall a memory. You don't tell the hair how to grow. You don't tell the heart how to beat. You don't tell the digestive system how to digest food. You don't even tell the legs how to walk. So if all of that can happen intelligently, because it all happens intelligently, if all of that can happen intelligently without you as the driver, then why not accept that the body can also speak and act and work without you as the driver? Why can't the same intelligence take care of that too? So again, he says a tremendously complex work is going on all the time in your brain and body. Are you conscious of it? Not at all. Yet for an outsider, all seems to be going on intelligently and purposefully. Why not admit that one's entire personal life may sink largely below the threshold of consciousness and yet proceed sanely and smoothly? The questioner says, is it normal? And Nisargadatta says, what is normal? Is your life obsessed by desires and fears, full of strife and struggle, meaningless and joyless, normal? To be acutely conscious of your body, is it normal? To be torn by feelings, tortured by thoughts, is it normal? A healthy body and a healthy mind live largely unperceived by their owner. Only occasionally through pain or suffering, they call for attention and insight. Why not extend the same to the entire personal life? One can function rightly, responding well and fully to whatever happens without having to bring it into the focus of awareness. When self-control becomes second nature, awareness shifts its focus to deeper levels of existence and action. So now he's really pointing to the experience of self-realization. It's the experience of being totally focused on the self all the time. And the body continues effortlessly. It's like hair growing is effortlessly now. The body continues to speak and act and work without attention needed, just like your hair grows without attention needed now. And as a result, the attention itself is able to be on the self, on awareness, on truth, all the time. And he just wants the questioner to accept that this is at least possible, even based on his own experience of how his hair grows or how his nails grow or how his brain deciphers language so that he understands it. It's interesting that he says when self-control becomes second nature, awareness shifts its focus to deeper levels of existence and action. So it makes it sound like, at least to me, that, you remember Nisargadatta talked a little earlier about a training period? It makes it sound like when this training period has become second nature, and I would say that's really because the brain has been reprogrammed. When that training period becomes second nature, and awareness is no longer needed to help us focus on things like choosing the right mind, to help us focus on things like watching awareness instead of watching thought. When it becomes second nature to choose the right mind and second nature to watch awareness instead of watching on thought, then awareness can shift away from the human aspect, from the training phase, and focus solely on the self and remain there. And the body is able to continue on without it. This is the same thing that Bernadette Roberts talks about in her book, What is the Self? She talks about the same training period, and she talks about the senses. The way she described it is the senses learn to be independent of awareness. Then awareness can shift to the first principle of God and remain with the first principle of God, and the body continues on looking the same to everyone else, when in fact, at the level of experience, it's really extremely different. The questioner says, don't you then become a robot? And Nisargadatta says, what harm is there in making automatic what is habitual and repetitive? It is automatic anyhow. But when it is also chaotic, it causes pain and suffering and calls for attention. The entire purpose of a clean and well-ordered life is to liberate man from the thrall of chaos and the burden of sorrow. The questioner says, you seem to be in favor of a computerized life. Nisargadatta says, what is wrong with a life that is free from problems? Personality is merely a reflection of the real. Why should not the reflection be true to the original as a matter of course, automatically? And what he means by that again is the personality is not real. It's really like a puppet. But why shouldn't it be a puppet of the right mind? Why have it be a puppet of the wrong mind, right? Why should not the reflection be true to the original as a matter of course, automatically? Need the person have any designs of its own? The life of which it is an expression will guide it. The life of which it is an expression will guide it. If you let go of thinking you're the driver, the right mind of consciousness will drive the body. Right? The right mind of interdependent co-arising will drive the body. If you just let go, the body will be driven properly by the, we could call it by the corrective arm of the Tao. Need the person have any designs of its own? The life of which it is an expression will guide it. Once you realize that the person is merely a shadow of the reality, but not really itself, you cease to fret and worry. You agree to be guided from within, and life becomes a journey into the unknown. And so I'd just like to emphasize this last sentence. You know, again, he does talk about this training period. And now what he is saying is that when we enter into this training period, what we really need to do is agree to be guided from within, from intuition. We're practicing discernment now. We're no longer just living based on the ego thoughts and the ego emotions like we were before. Now we go within, we learn discernment, we follow the intuition instead of the thinking mind. We disregard the ego. We practice rest, accept, and trust. We practice self-inquiry, awareness, watching awareness, right? All this is going on during the training period, and it leads us into the journey of the unknown, which is self-realization, which he is trying to explain, and yet, as we can tell, the questioner cannot understand. So the only way to really understand is to follow our own inner guide and have the direct experience of self-realization ourselves. Again, a three-year-old cannot understand an adult. The only way to understand an adult is to become an adult yourself. And with that said, I release the mic, and thank you very much. Ken, I'll give you a name in just a moment.